Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. We're very pleased to welcome to the podcast this week Sir Kenneth Branagh, whose new film, All Is True, is out on DVD this week.
My husband thinks you've come home to die.
Really? Yeah. I've just bought a pension. I can't die for at least 10 years or I'll be ruined.
So why are you come home? No more stories left to write?
Susanna, I've lived so long in imaginary worlds, I think I've lost sight of what is real, what is true.
Kenneth, welcome to the podcast.
Thank
Congratulations on All Is True. For anyone who hasn't seen it, just give us a basic outline of what the fundamental setup is of the story.
All Is True concerns the last 3 years in the life of William Shakespeare, and the film begins dramatically when Shakespeare's famous Globe Theatre burns down in June of 1613, and the play that's on the premiere is The Life of Henry VIII, which also has an alternate title, All Is True. And we then follow Shakespeare, who returns to his hometown, Stratford-upon-Avon. There's about 2,500 people at that time. And across the next 3 years, we look at the facts of his life. And we, in a Shakespearean way, because he always did this, took the facts of famous people's lives and filled in the gaps.
Yeah.
And we try to do that with a life that's actually, that part of his life is relatively unexplored, at least on film. And so it was an opportunity to see what happens to the great man when he gets back to face a family that haven't seen him for the best part of 20 years, as he's been off being a massive celebrity, and how he sort of comes to terms with who he is in his own backyard.
When you say he's been off being a massive celebrity, he's been off being William Shakespeare.
Yeah.
But the sort of the juxtaposition is between him, you know, the great bard, the great writer who's written all these plays, and his home life, in which his wife apparently can't read or write, mm-hmm. and his daughters are at the centre of a kind of scandal. How true is that?
So, for instance, the sexual scandals involving the daughters is absolutely true. In the film, you'll see a moment where Susanna Shakespeare in Holy Trinity Church is accused by a man called John Lane of adultery,
yeah.
and indeed of having gonorrhea was what actually happened. That did happen in the church, and it is recorded. The other daughter, Judith, married a man, Thomas Quiney, who 6 weeks after their marriage was discovered to have had another sexual affair out of wedlock with a woman called Margaret Wheeler, who then died in childbirth. Mother and baby both died. He was again brought to book at Holy Trinity and was punished by being made to walk through the town on three successive Sundays in his nightshirt. Both events were Stratford-wide in terms of their implication.
And both massively theatrical, declaration in a church, a walking through the
yes,
street.
Yes, isn't it? But of course, there's a very litigious society. They were always suing each other in Stratford. There was in Shakespeare's own time, his father had gone bust. He was accused of, and indeed arrested for usury. He had been mayor of the town, but then had a terrible fall from grace. The people would shop you at the drop of a hat, it would seem. He was done on one occasion for just a regulation that meant that you could not have manure had to be placed in sort of, as it were, where the recycling bins needed to be. And he got his much, much closer to the house because it was much easier. He had lots of livestock to deal with. And he was shopped for this and he was then punished for this. So Stratford was full of that kind of thing. And that was the place that Shakespeare came back to and in which he was sort of trying to find himself again and find a way to sort of process this status. As you say, he'd achieved as the most prominent writer of the age, but as with most people of achievement, their own particular status in their own towns or in their own families particularly is not the same as the way the rest of the world sees them.
Well, well, Mr. Shakespeare. How very unfortunate. Seems your daughter's wedding was rushed for a reason. Like your own, eh? The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Damn me, you Shakespeares are a scandalous lot. Perhaps being an illiterate farm girl, your wife was unable to teach your girls morals. Well, well, must be getting on. Can't loll about all day thinking pretty thoughts like you poets. I must do business.
Business, Sir Thomas?
Yes, business. A large estate like Charlecote doesn't run itself, you know.
Oh, I thought you meant real business. Like building, owning and operating London's largest theatre, for instance. Actors, carpenters, seamstresses, crew to pay, bribes to pay, security to mount, politics to navigate, 3,000 paying customers to be fed and watered every afternoon, each promised a spectacle greater than the last, 170 royal command performances for our Queen and our King. Have you ever considered the logistics of mounting the Battle of Shrewsbury in the banqueting hall at Hampton Court? Please don't. It would make you so tired. And yet, in all the years that I have run my vast, complex and spectacularly successful business, Thomas, I have indeed found the time to think and to write down the pretty thoughts you mention and which, in my experience, bring immense pleasure to those who seek mere diversion or respite from this veil of tears, without which it would all be about as pointless as... well, about as pointless as you, Sir Thomas.
What do you think was the basis of his relationship with his wife? According to the story that we see, they got married because they had conceived. But, you know, astonishing that William Shakespeare should be married to somebody who apparently couldn't read or write and had only passing knowledge of his verse.
He was 18 when he married her, so he's an 18-year-old country lad.
She was 26,
yeah. And many would argue that his own education was not something about which we could be certain at that time.
Okay.
We more or less understand that he went to Stratford Grammar School. People would dispute this, but given the nature of his father's preeminence in the town, it seems likely. So, as Ben Jonson said, he possibly only knew a little Latin and even less Greek. So he may not have been, in the conventional terms, as broadly educated as we might assume at that time, although he could have been. One way or another, a woman 8 years his senior was someone who attracted him enough to not only get married then, but also to somehow sustain a relationship in which he did visit. I mean, he did come back,
yeah.
Usually about once a year. It took about 3 days up to come to Stratford at that time. It would have felt like going to Venus, I'm sure, really such a long way from in noise and sound and,
yeah.
and population from London. She, as they say, must have had something. And we started the basis for the portrayal of Anne Hathaway with Judi Dench's own performance for us in a production of The Winter's Tale, Shakespeare's late play, a couple of years ago in the West End. And this is a character, Paulina, that she played in The Winter's Tale, who is regularly voted by actors as their favourite female Shakespeare character. It's partly, I think, because she speaks truth to power. She's very passionate, very intelligent, acerbic and uncompromising. She voices a very female response to certain kind of male position, particularly relative to male vanity or ego. In The Winter's Tale, Leontes, the king of Sicilia, has this appalling fit of jealousy, believes his wife is unfaithful, and the series of disasters that follow result ultimately in the death of his child, his son, probably from a broken heart. That's the implication in the play. And she never lets him off the hook. We thought that was a strong position to start thinking about Anne Hathaway, if they are still married, and they do come back and they take possession of the second best house in Stratford, the house famously owned by the Clopton, Sir Thomas Clopton, who was really the sort of founder of Stratford. It was important to Shakespeare, this idea of status. One of the daughters was married to the town doctor. As you know, he came back and he bought a coat of arms for £20.
£20.
He bought a coat of arms and, you know, worth maybe 3,000 or 4,000 quid. Now, it was important to him that he had the right to insist that people call him gentleman. Somehow Anne Hathaway was part of that sort of axis that meant as a family unit, they were somehow armed strong in some kind of togetherness. They were there across those following 3 years, in which it's not hard to imagine some of the dissension between them. Ian McKellen, who plays the Earl of Southampton in our film, did a one-man show probably 20, 25 years ago in which he argued, he used to do a Q&A with the audience and say, please tell me, you're all, the people were often very schooled in Shakespeare, but he said, whether you are, whether you're not, please tell me if you think there's a successful marriage in any Shakespeare play. Because he believes there is not. There's not a single successful marriage, with the exception of the Macbeths, who of course murder people. And so if that's a way to make your marriage function, it's questionable. I think Ben Elton felt that the marriage, whilst surviving, would not be short of the friction that might be occurring between two people who also, along with the rest of the family, had suffered this immense loss, just because infant mortality was high and usual at the time of this story, would not diminish, and we understand this from literature and accounts of the time, does not diminish the grief of the family who lose the child. Yeah. And so that central resolution and that central element of Shakespeare and the family being haunted, literally haunted, by the death of Hamnet was key to the way we told the story.
Yeah, so Hamnet, his son, who was 11 or 12 when he died.
11, yeah.
And all the way through the story, through the film, Shakespeare himself is haunted by this loss. And during the course of the narrative, we discover that certain things that he thought were true may not be true. And I have to say, I mean, I did Shakespeare at A level, and I did English literature at university, and it may be a massive failure of the education system. I didn't even know about Hamnet.
Yes.
So I was very, very struck by this. But then I went, to look stuff at, how could I not have known? And of course, actually, not that much is known, is it? I
mean, it's one of the things that is continually perplexing for Shakespearean scholars. But we do know what the film states is correct, that in the summer of 1596, a very, very, very small, an unusually small number of children died in Stratford across months and years, where many, many, many more had done because of the outbreak of plague, which was regular, and often fires in Stratford at that time. Which caused great loss of life. And although generally speaking, the idea of Hamnet being lost to the plague was one that has become current, the possibility that something else may have been at play was a departure point for Ben Elton, that also connects to the kind of thing that Shakespeare was writing about, particularly in the last plays. In the late plays, the Tempest, the Winter's Tale, Cymbeline, and Pericles all deal with lost children. Often they deal with dead children, and they deal usually with magic, because essentially you might describe them as fairy tales. Mm-hmm. They all become plays that want to make it all right. They want to make that happy ending that, alas, life in the case of those tragic circumstances will not give. In some cases, Shakespeare gave voice to quite direct grief about this. Earlier on in a play, King John, he talks about Arthur. Grief fills the room up with my absent child. He writes 8 or 10 lines of the most beautiful, exquisite, painful expression of what it is to lose a child and to miss the child, and eternally. He also, of course, across the plays, constantly plays with the idea of twins and what being a twin means. Is it some sort of special, additional, sibling plus feeling that you have?
It's a superpower.
It is a superpower, and we know we're all often very envious of the sort of telepathy between twins, and the separation between them, which happens in half a dozen plays also, is right there. So we took that fact about the question mark over Hamnet's death and the circumstantial evidence to suggest that it may not have been a straight forward, as others might immediately surmise, to then go back via the plays for that which, in a play like Hamlet, for instance, where another daughter with a challenging relationship with her father, Ophelia, with Polonius, is driven into a circumstance that produces, again, a supposition about how her life might end, that I think has been as it were, in Shakespeare's sort of creative workshop.
Anne?
The Earl of Southampton makes a progress north, and he writes to me here that since he passes close by, he will spend an hour or two in talk with me. You hear me, Anne? The Earl of Southampton.
I heard you. And I recall the first day I heard about your friend, the Earl of Southampton. The same day as a book of poems was published. Sonnets, they told me. Suppose you thought, because I couldn't read, I wouldn't mind. But plenty of people can read, even in our little town. Including one of your own daughters.
And those sonnets were published illegally without my knowledge or my consent.
But you wrote them, Will, and people read them. And after they'd read them, they kept asking, who are they? Who is this dark lady so in love with?
They were just
the
poems.
Handsome man?
They were just poems.
Don't answer. I don't want to know. I didn't want to know then, and I don't want to know now.
I've had the great privilege over the years of interviewing you several times, both you know, on stage and on television and for radio. And every time you talk about Shakespeare, you seem as excited about it as the first time you ever did. And I'm now, you know, you're in the middle of touring with the film, so you must be talking about this a lot. And yet you've never seemed anything other than completely fired up by the subject of Shakespeare. And I remember being at Radio 1 when Hamlet came out and we made it Movie of the Month. And the radio, we think, Hamlet? We're Radio 1, we're a pop station. But no, but believe me, people will get this because there's a vibrancy in it. So having had all of that, to be playing Shakespeare, it's okay, or there's a great... I mean, it would be like me playing Elvis or something.
Well, you know, it connects, is what I would say. It connects... When I first went to Stratford, I was 16. It was my first solo trip out into the world. So these things are important to you. They're very memorable.
You grew up in Belfast, and then
yeah, and I grew up in Belfast, and I left when I was 9. And I knew that I came from a rich culture that really valued words and stories, but not necessarily in written form. Mm-hmm. My early memories of storytelling are large numbers of people in very, very small rooms. People sat on the edge of sofas. My dad with a Guinness, and my mother singing a very painful song called Marguerite. And other people telling me stories about Ireland, about Buck Alec, who kept a toothless lion in the backyard in Nelson Street. A very violent lion, but because the teeth were out, you were safe, but he could give you a terrible suck, is what they used to say. So I grew up with a lot of baloney and blarney going on, and that sort of world of being interested in stories about the near and the far, and also an interest in music, and Irish melancholy and everything that comes with a full package when you get the 100% Shamrock blood. And so to come over to England and then meet, as I did in my first viewing of a Shakespeare play, Romeo and Juliet, in a church in North London, St. George's in Tufnell Park, 1,000 kids on a Wednesday afternoon. A beautiful woman called Sarah Bedell was playing Juliet. She's quite breathtaking, so unbelievably sexy. Peter McHenry playing Romeo. Great fights.
You're remembering this like it was yesterday.
Oh, my God. But it also was like a riot. I mean, it was like a riot. It was also a riot in church. I came from a place where church was Sunday night, you had to give the family's money, put it on the collection plate. I was watching Ian Paisley's deputy, Martin Smith. They're not when you get, when you're dead. You will face a fork in the road, and the long straight road will lead you to heaven, and the narrow winding road will take you to hell, and you must never forget which road to take. And I get home and go, Christ, what road was it? I remember waking up in the night going, there's two roads, I've got to choose one of them. Oh, no, can I write in? Could I ask him? So I've come from that. Now I'm at a riot in a church, and the riot's caused by a play called William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, 400 years old, and it's about gangs, it's about violence, it's clearly about sex, although I couldn't have said that because just my hormones were just in a state of complete confusion, except I know I liked her a lot. And a lot of other guys were the same way. So the noise in the audience was constant, first experience of a sort of globe audience. And I knew when I got back, I thought something had happened. When I got back, but that's supposed to be the dreary old dry thing, isn't it? So this sort of, cultural medicine stuff. So when I went to a couple of years later and thought, well, I've got to know about this man. I went to Stratford enough, and I was a fairly timid you know, adolescent in this way. But so getting your tent on your back, my tent, which I had spent 20 weeks, $9.99, 20 weeks at 99p or whatever it was, $20.99 from my mum's catalogue. I'd sent for like the worst tent in the world. So this is a tent you couldn't, you know, it wouldn't have, you could have shaken a wet J cloth at it and you'd have been soaked. It was so, there was nothing like kind of like a, you know, a ground sheet or anything. Took that to Stratford. Took me forever to hitchhike. The first truck I tried to get up and into, I fell straight back. The weight of my rucksack was so heavy. I was the pillock, absolute pillock. But when I got there and I walked down from the campsite, a mile and a half into Stratford, I felt, I saw the statue of him in the gardens, then I walked across, got into the queue, got a ticket that night for The Taming of the Shrew with Jonathan Pryce, Paolo Dionysetti, a great show by Michael Bogdanovich, which began with the set being torn down by a man who appeared to have come out of the audience, Jonathan Pryce's Christopher Sly. Everybody in that audience started running out of the theatre. So I was at another Shakespeare play that began with a riot. So for me, Shakespeare did not associate itself with something quiet and sonorous and beautiful. It was wild. And so across those few days, I'd see the plays, I'd queue up, I'd get my ticket sometimes up in the balcony, looking like diagonally down, very vertically and scary. And then I'd go and see the Birthplace Places. And it was the beginning of going, who was the man? What's the work? How does that join up? Wow, these are so, he wasn't so well off. He may not have been educated. Wow. You know, it was also understanding that this man, you know, we were a bunch of comprehensive kids who'd gone to see that play. He was a fellow who came from a smallish town, a market town in the middle of the country, went off and made a great success. There were certain kinds of things that made kind of sense. So by the time, cut to 40 years later, the very first time we do a makeup test, and I've done this thing deliberately of closing my eyes, and then 2 hours later, Vanessa White, the makeup designer, and Neil Gorton had put the prosthetics on, said you could open them, and I opened them. And it was quite moving, actually. It was quite moving to have this sort of... this experience, which was a kind of it's something I really had a flash of being back at Stratford all those years ago, and of course it had come out of this sort of communion with the picture of Shakespeare in the National Portrait Gallery, Room 3, the Chandos portrait. We think it's him. People say it's him. Others would dispute it, but a guy called John Taylor probably painted it in 1608. It's Mona Lisa. It looks you straight in the eye. It always reminds me, if you're interested in a painting, try and find a way to see the real thing, because the reproductions are nothing like it. So you go and see that portrait of Shakespeare, and I swear to God, that man's looking at you. Yeah. He's looking at you. There's a warmth, there's a depth, there's a wryness in those eyes. I felt I was given permission. I felt I was given permission. There's a twinkle in the eye. I said, yeah, you'll get it wrong as well. But, you know, go on, have a go. A smile, something that we extended into our title, which all is true. Well, maybe not, but maybe.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
That thing about the painting that may or may not, because apparently at Corpus Christi there is the painting of Christopher Marlowe, but it might not be him. This is some bloke around about that time. They've decided that that's who it is, but it might not be.
Yeah.
But there is, I mean, that, I mean, I was really struck by, because in real life, you don't look like Shakespeare.
No,
God bless you, but you don't. But on camera, it looks like what I think Shakespeare should look like. And actually, I confess, I was watching for a while before I went, the nose is a different shape, which I know now is obvious. Of course, it didn't immediately occur to me. What I was struck by was it looks like I imagine William Shakespeare to look. Yeah. But what about the rest of it? The walk, I mean, obviously, the costume is something you're familiar with, but how did you stand to be Shakespeare?
Well, it was just, I found that I was talking about it with Ian McKellen, and something came out of the script, at least in the first part of it, was that there was a rather sort of bewildered quality to Shakespeare. The word that I love that is used about him often by people who wrote about him, Hemmings and Condell, who produced the first volume of plays, the first folio, the first collected works, if you like, describe in the introduction, they refer to him as gentle. Ben Jonson does the same thing in his sort of semi-eulogistic funeral piece, gentle. And that gentleness, I think, for me, it fired up an image of a man, an observer, a man who was not front-footed. The play, the parts in the plays that we know he probably played in his in his theatre were, on the whole, were quieter parts, you know, gentler parts. He played William in As You Like It, who's a sort of, you know, lovely, sappy, sort of dopey fella, in the terms of that play. So, for me, that gentleness was also going to lead in the first part of the play, especially in how it related to his physicality, to a stillness, to a relatively still quality, that he's... We believe, again, you were talking about the Marlowe issue, you talked to Shakespearean scholars, and the general feeling is that, with some evidence to suggest as much, that he was traumatized by the loss of that theatre. This is a theatre, at one stage during its life, they'd carried it timber by timber in the middle of the night across the river to Bankside when the laws changed. They lived hand to mouth. Sometimes they had successes, sometimes they didn't. 37 of his plays, or his plays in collaboration with other people, were put on. Plus, there were tons of other plays by Jonson and Fletcher and all the rest of it. So an enormous amount of his life had been wrapped up in that place as writer and actor and producer. It's gone catastrophically, and he goes back, and I think you find a shell-shocked, traumatized man whose general disposition, it would seem to me, sits nicely with the word gentle. He listened, he observed. If you have that much knowledge of the higher and lower echelons of society, I think you found a way to create a warmth that people that allowed people to be themselves, for him to gather that information. And so to then see him sort of knocked around a bit by the sort of rough and tumble of family life back and smacking him right between the eyes, I felt like he was walking in sort of cotton wool, so he didn't really know where to put himself, including, despite his vast knowledge in the plays about plants and herbs and flowers, in the garden, in the way he is literally trying to find himself again. And what he's looking for, which so many of us do, don't we, is you're looking for a chance to go back, in his case, to his hometown and somehow make that connection between what he was and who he is. Quite a lot of it remains the same, but then this great big interval of fame and celebrity and achievement got in the way. But he's a human being, so he doesn't necessarily believe all of that. And then he has these other undercurrents of feeling like, well, you know, who is he drawn to in the love game? He's come back to be with the woman that he began a family with, but Ben Elton introduces this whole swerve and kind of curveball that is the Earl of Southampton arriving and suggesting perhaps Shakespeare may have been gay or bisexual or both.
You must write again, Will. London needs you. I need you. We have only Jonson now.
Who laughs at me because I speak no Greek and don't know whether Bohemia has a coast.
Oh, Christ, well, why do you care what he thinks? You wrote King Lear.
I care because it matters, Your Grace. Well, in England it matters. I have what I have upon my own merit, and for that I'm suspect. Well, perhaps I'll always be suspect. But I have my money, and I have my houses, and I have my coat of arms.
And you have your verses. Christ, man, you have your poetry, such beautiful, beautiful poetry. Some of it. Some of it was writ for me.
Yes. Yes, Your Grace. For you.
That scene is it's wonderful, and I love the way that we hear the same verse read twice with completely different emphasis, and it changes the way what that means or what it may mean. My favourite scene in the film is the scene when he's out in the garden and the young man comes up and says, "I just need to ask you." And he's just like, "What?" And what I love about that scene is it has this, I mean, obviously it's an invention, but it has the smack of reality about it. Yeah. You know, you're willing to, "What?"
Yes.
So tell me about that. What's happening in that scene?
Well, Ben Elton was very keen that he said, look, well, first of all, we talked way back about right now in 2019, what would people like to know about William Shakespeare if you had the chance, if you were at the fictional dinner party or whatever? And quite a lot of people might say, how did you do it? How did you know? How did you come up with all this stuff? And one might imagine that he'd been asked a very, very many times. a line that we cut from the movie but explained exactly who this student was, he said, but I came from Cambridge. I took the time off. I've come all this way. You could imagine, couldn't you, if he was alive today, people would come, as they do, from every corner of the globe to see the RSC, to go to Shakespeare's Globe, to go to Stratford itself. And so that funny combination of a man who carries the mantle of the enormity and prolific nature of the work, he's glad of an audience, wants it, but is often dealing with a question that he may not even know how to answer himself.
Yeah.
That disparity between geniuses and their lives was really brought home to me when I looked at some of the correspondence of Mozart. Very, very potty-mouthed individual, leading a larky, salty life through his letters, and very interested in what he might be doing to his missus on his return from wherever it was, Salzburg. Not the image of the sublime maker of the beautiful concerto, yeah, written on the air in gossamer, and there's a guy who's mostly interested in what she's going to be wearing when he walks in.
How do you know?
Just what I know. If I know, and I don't say that I do, I have imagined.
But they say that you left school at 14. You never travelled. Imagine from what?
From myself.
Yourself?
Yes. Everything I've ever done, everything I've ever seen, every book I've ever read, every conversation I've ever had, including, God help me, this one. If you want to be a writer and speak to others and for others, speak first for yourself. Search within. Consider the contents of your own soul, your humanity. And if you're honest with yourself, then whatever you write, all is true.
The time has flown by, so a last thing. You made this kind of under the radar because it was that was a decision because you just wanted, because you've done Murder on the Orient Express and, you know, heaven knows you've done enough big productions, superheroes, all that. Was it a deliberate thing so that you were doing it completely on your own terms?
There was suddenly a moment where it could happen and things came together, and yes, it was to reduce the scale of the work to go to a chamber piece where we were talking a little before we sort of came on air a little bit about things that that you create that turn out the way you hope for without compromise, which is not to say that they are definitive, but mainly that they have that characteristic that what you tried to do is what you
they
did.
Are the, yeah, you made yeah. the thing that you wanted to make,
exactly,
for better or worse.
And in that case, that was the intention going into this, and it was what happened on the way out. And much of it was also to do with the way in which it was done as well. So we were small scale, we were short, we were brief, we were working with people, largely with people we knew, but with lots of new people as well. But we exploited and you know, harnessed and nourished the qualities that are there if you've worked like with Judy for 10, 11, 12 times or something, and a lot of the other collaborators on it, and it felt like fine brushwork. It was going to be, as I said to when I pitched it to Ben, I said, this is a kind of, it's a rumination, it's a meditation. I know that the facts of the life will give us plenty of lean-in kind of, you know, drama, but it's okay for it to be quiet. It's okay for it to be slow. It's okay for it to be tender. It's okay for it to be introspective, if that's what it needs to be. Not as a sort of an indulgence, but we're talking about a particular moment in the life of a particular man. We must allow it to be what it needs to be, and what it needs to be in the end is what you saw when you watched the picture.
That is what it feels like, and I think that's a really lovely thing to make the movie you want to make, not the movie that somebody else wants you to make. So, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The wonderful Sir Kenneth Branagh, and if you like the sound of All Is True, it's out on DVD this week. Thanks for listening, and remember, if you enjoy the podcast, please do subscribe.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.